he, in that role, had a very important role in overseeing the investigations into both Hillary Clinton's email server and also the early stages of the Russia investigation. And President Trump had spent a good part of this weekend going after him on Twitter, in part because of something that President Trump has actually been going after him for since, let's go back to the archives again, October 2016, when he first started talking about McCabe on the campaign trail. His complaint with McCabe is that in 2015, before McCabe was deputy director of the FBI, McCabe's wife ran for the state Senate in Virginia as a Democrat and got substantial campaign donations from organizations linked to the state's Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe, who is close to Hillary Clinton. So that is the connection. Trump says that that is a conflict of interest, and he's been pointing that out, especially in recent days. McCabe did not become deputy director of the FBI until after his wife had lost that race.
This is all part of what we've been seeing coming from the president and his allies, though, suggesting political bias. I mean, in the Justice Department, the FBI. I mean, this is all sort of part and parcel with that.
This is absolutely part of that. President Trump saying and tweeting things about the FBI being in tatters, even as he has now his own director in there. And that director has not gotten rid of Andrew McCabe. The director comes in, he can replace people. He did not immediately replace McCabe with his own folks.
And if you're the FBI, how are they responding to, this pointed criticism from the president of the United States?
My colleagues who cover the Justice Department say that there is some frustration that this is a law enforcement agency that's supposed to be sort of separate from politics, and yet there's been very much wrapped up into politics because the president keeps roping them into it. And there's some concern that if McCabe ends up retiring next year, early next year, as he's expected to do, that it could be seen as bowing to political pressure from the president.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith joining us on this Christmas morning. Tam, thanks. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And we're going to turn now to the Vatican. Pope Francis appeared on the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica today to deliver a Christmas Day message to Rome and to the world. Now, this pope has traditionally used his messages to focus on conflicts that are afflicting the world today. NPR's Sylvia Bajoli is on the line with us from Rome. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi there.
So the Pope spoke yesterday, too. He spoke on Christmas Eve, and he talked about very pressing issues. He talked about war and refugees and migration, poor people. What did he say in the message today? What were some of the differences?
He talked about many of exactly those same themes, weaving the story of the Nativity with the many crises afflicting the world.
Oggi, mentre sul mondo soffiano venti di guerra,
he said, today, as the winds of war blowing in our world and an outdated model of development continues to produce human, societal, and environmental decline, Christmas invites us to recognize Jesus in the faces of the little children, especially those for whom, like Jesus, there is no place in the inn. He went on to say that we see Jesus in the children suffering from growing tensions between Israelis and Palestinians, in the faces of Syrian children marked by war, and those of Iraq, Yemen, South Sudan, many other African nations. He referred to the children of unemployed parents, of those forced to work and those enrolled as soldiers, and the many minors traveling alone who are an easy target for human traffickers. And the Pope made a very clear call for a negotiated two-state solution to the end of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I just want to add that I just got an email from the Vatican that says 50,000 people were in the square to listen to the Pope.
My goodness. This call for a negotiated end or a negotiated two-state solution to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, does this come as a surprise at all?
Oh, not at all.
Not
this
at
is
all.
Certainly,
Mm-mm.
This has been a longstanding Vatican position. And this is the second time the Pope Francis has spoken out quite forcefully on this issue since President Trump made his announcement about the move, moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem.
Francis has been Pope for almost 5 years now. He's seen as a big player on the international stage. He's seen as a powerful man. What have been the highlights of his papacy in 2017?
Well, this year he traveled to Egypt, to Portugal, to Colombia and Myanmar and Bangladesh. The focus was always on interfaith relations with Islam and with Buddhism, the persecution of Christians in some countries, and his personal desire to be close to Catholics where they are small communities in predominantly non-Christian countries. He's often described the current world situation as a third world war being fought piecemeal. And this year, he focused a lot on the threat of nuclear weapons. Last month, the Vatican held a major conference urging nuclear disarmament. And during his return flight from Asia early this month, the Pope did not directly mention tensions between North Korea and the U.S., but he spoke about what he called the irrationality in the world today. He warned that human knowledge and progress has reached the point where man has the capacity to blast humanity back to the Stone Age.
Some really strong words there. You know, this was a Pope who came in with a mandate to really reform the Vatican's bureaucracy, to make its very complicated financial systems more transparent. Has he made any progress along those lines?
Well, he's made some progress. He has streamlined many of the Vatican departments. There is a little bit more transparency in the Vatican's finances, not complete. It had a very, very bad reputation, very shady. Probably the most significant development, however, in the church this year has been a much more overt opposition to Pope Francis from conservatives, conservative Catholics. They're very much opposed to his cautious opening to communion for divorced and civilly married Catholics. In September, a group of theologians wrote a letter that they went so far as to accuse him of heresy. Now, he has more or less ignored the charges. He has made some personnel changes. He got rid of the head of the very powerful Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, Cardinal Mueller, and who was increasingly associated with this opposition to the controversial communion story. But he has more or less ignored them. What's much more worrisome for Francis is more the grumbling within the Curia, the Vatican bureaucracy, towards his governing methods and his open criticism of the Curia. So as he goes into 2018, perhaps he has the biggest issue for him will be the growing resistance within his own ranks.
All right. Well, we'll be keeping an eye on that with your help, NPR's Sylvia Pajoli. Sylvia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
And good morning. It's 8:18. Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you're enjoying the Christmas morning. NPR headlines are coming up next. And during the WPR newscast, a Wisconsin business owner is rebuilding years after protests and rioting in Milwaukee caused his gas station to go up in flames. More on that story in a couple of minutes during the statewide newscast.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lakelawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lakelawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakelawnResort.com.
Impact on the community. WPR is pleased to promote live theater. More information at wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Winsor Johnston. President Trump is once again lashing out at the FBI. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports he's attacking Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, who's planning to retire soon.
McCabe is a career FBI official. He's been at the Bureau for more than 20 years. He was named Deputy Director by James Comey in January of 2016. This is the number two position at the Bureau, which gave him a central role, of course, in two of the biggest and most high-profile cases of late. That would be the Clinton email server investigation and the Russia probe. He also, you may remember, famously stepped in as acting director after Comey was fired in May. And McCabe is expected to retire early next year when he's eligible for his full pension, and that's been the plan for some time.
NPR's Ryan Lucas. A winter storm is bringing several inches of snow to parts of New England. The National Weather Service says strong winds are also predicted for Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. Outside the Northeast, most of the nation's additional snowfall will be confined to the central and northern Rocky Mountains.
That's where we expect another 4 to 8, maybe some additional higher amounts in those areas. Perhaps some lighter snows western Nebraska, you know, spilling into those higher plains in the central plains. So that's going to be an area of concern. Let's say North Platte, Nebraska, for example, 2 to 4 inches of snow.
That's meteorologist Brian Hurley with the National Weather Service. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air.
Who is the greatest?
We are the greatest.
I should.
Yeah.
Past tense.
Yeah.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. State and local law enforcement have stepped up road and highway patrols for the end of the year. The Department of Transportation says the increased police presence is part of the Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over campaign. David Pabst is director of the Bureau of Transportation Safety. He says drugs and alcohol continue to be factors in a large number of fatal crashes.
Drug driving is starting to take the place of drunk driving, although drunk driving with alcohol is still a serious, serious problem.
PAP says distracted driving is also on the rise in Wisconsin. The state says there have been 577 traffic fatalities as of mid-December. That's slightly more than the total traffic deaths in last year. The owner of a Milwaukee gas station that went up in flames during riots over a police shooting last year has started to rebuild. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that construction on the BP station began in late November. The completion date has not been set. The station's owner, Pakara Singh, was at the site this week watching the work. The gas station burned in August of 2016 during unrest after office seat Dominique Hagan Brown fatally shot Sylville Smith during a foot chase. Hagan Brown was acquitted of any wrongdoing in the shooting, but he was fired in October of 2016 after he was charged with sexual assault in a separate case. You're listening to WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, an online resource dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students with information and strategies about what works in K-12 education. From Hiscox Insurance, providing customized insurance for small and medium businesses so they can do more and be more. Learn more at HISCOX.com or from an agent. Hiscox Insurance. Encourage courage. From MileIQ, the MileIQ app automatically tracks business miles to streamline and maximize deductions or expenses. The MileIQ app is available for download in the App Store and Google Play. And from the William T. Grant Foundation at WTGrantFoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. Parents make all kinds of sacrifices for their children, but what do you do when you want to save your child from experiencing the same kind of suffering you have experienced? NPR's Michael May brings us the story of one father who's searching for a way to ease his son's discomfort that's caused by a shared genetic disorder.
Carl Lupker suffers from dystonia, a disorder that causes involuntary muscle spasms. When I met him 30 years ago, Carl's spasms were in his right hand. Then they spread to the muscles of his face until they garbled his speech. Last December, Carl sat down in the office of his neurologist, Dr. Gerald Vitek, to discuss a surgery called deep brain stimulation.
My fears are obviously first is death.
It's not an easy decision to let a doctor drill a hole in your skull and put electrodes deep in your brain.
Those are my three biggest fears are death, loss of cognition, and any behavioral changes I might incur from the procedure.
Well, Carl, what I would say is that the potential risk is about a 1 to 2% chance that there would be a significant bleed. That's the greatest risk. The chance of benefit is marked. The vast majority of people will benefit.
Deep brain stimulation has been called a pacemaker for the brain. It regulates the neurons that are misfiring. It's used for everything from Parkinson's disease to major depression. Scientists still don't understand exactly why DBS works, but for some patients, it dramatically reduces symptoms. At first, scientists literally destroyed the part of the brain that was malfunctioning. Vitek says there's a reason doctors would be willing to try something so brutal.
One word will answer that: desperation.
Carl kept desperation at bay for decades. He just worked around the dystonia. He taught sixth grade, got married, had kids. From the outside, his life looked normal. But around a year ago, desperation hit. Carl's type of dystonia is hereditary, and his 10-year-old son Liam was diagnosed with it. Liam's pain got so bad, he started wearing an ankle brace to calm the spasms in his leg. He knows he could become unable to walk, and he fears the worst.
I'm afraid it's not going to get cured, and I have to live the rest of my life with this horrible disease.
Liam knows what's in store. He's watched his father struggle more each year until it finally got to the point where it's difficult to talk or even cut his own food.
First, I kind of felt embarrassed when he came with me to places. But then when I grew a little more mature, I grew more sympathy for him.
Liam has always been a sensitive kid, but dystonia has made him even more empathetic.
I can feel sympathy for people who don't get sympathy because their disorder is unnoticed by the world and not many people know or care.
Liam is already beginning to lose the things he loves to do, like skateboard. He recently got so frustrated, he smashed it on the sidewalk. Carl quit his job and went on disability so he could care for Liam full time.
What can't I help you with?
Pain.
And the pain is getting worse. Carl believes that Liam's best hope is deep brain stimulation. It may seem like an extreme solution, but Carl has tried the dystonia drugs. They made him paranoid and blurred his vision. He says you don't want to drug your kid.
And then drug your kid more and more and more, just so he can walk and be in a stupor.
Carl's hoping if the procedure works for him, then Liam will have the courage to do it himself. In January, Carl went into surgery. They drilled a hole in his skull and slowly eased the electrodes a few centimeters into the brain. They guide the electrodes to the right area by listening. They literally pick up the sounds of nerves firing. The activity in different areas of the brain sound distinct. Dr. Park is the surgeon who operated on Carl.
So it's much like traveling through Europe, and as soon as you cross the border, the people start speaking different language. You know, it's almost like that, okay? And we know where we're going.
Carl is awake the whole time. There are no pain receptors in the brain, and they need Carl to be conscious. Liam was at school that day.
I was so anxious at school, just thinking every moment, every cut, every stitch. I could kind of feel it, and I threw up at school that day, actually.
The surgery went well. Then they turned on the electrodes. Carl said it felt like putting his tongue on a battery.
Felt that kind of electricity.
I visited him a few months later. He shows me the remote control that he uses to adjust the electricity in his brain.
And I can even turn it off, and you can kind of see my hands cramping up there.
When he turns it back on, I can see his hand relaxing. The surgery didn't significantly reduce his symptoms. He says he feels less pain through the day, but his ability to speak has only slightly improved. But he got what he hoped for. After the surgery, his son Liam decided to get TBS. I visited Liam in September. I hadn't seen him for about 10 months, and back then he was in constant pain from muscle cramps in his foot and was wearing an ankle brace. Now he whizzed by me on a skateboard, pushing with the same foot that had been in the brace.
You look great.
Thanks.
How does it feel?
Feels like I never had dystonia.
It's a bit of a mystery why the surgery worked better for Liam than Carl. Doctors suspect it might be because he's younger and his disease is less advanced. TBS hasn't cured Liam, but it has given him the ability to control the symptoms and hopefully stop them from getting worse.
I think that it's going to halt the progression, or at least that's what the doctors say. But if I'm feeling as good as I am now for the rest of my life, that would be pretty amazing.
When Carl was growing up, he just had to accept that the dystonia would rob him of the ability to do the things he loved. But Liam, he doesn't have to think that way. And Carl told me it's like getting his son back. Michael May, NPR News.
Support for your health comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing help with bathing, medication reminders, and Alzheimer's and dementia care to keep seniors at home. Homeinstead.com/NPR.
This is NPR News.
Why do Jews traditionally eat Chinese food on Christmas? We investigate.
A man by the name of Eng Shi Chuck brought chow mein on Christmas Day to the Jewish Children's Home in Newark, New Jersey. That's the first written citation of Jews eating Chinese food on Christmas.
I'm Ari Shapiro, a Kung Pao Christmas this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Don't miss All Things Considered today from 4 to 6:30 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and coming up this hour still, Merriam-Webster issues its top 10 words every year. What are this year's words, and what do they say about society? Find out in 15 minutes. Good morning, it is 8:30. I'm Maureen McCollum. In Wisconsin Public Radio news, an agricultural apprenticeship program that began in Wisconsin in 2010 has spread to 10 states and is registered with the U.S. Department of Labor. The Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship partners experienced farmers with beginners. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Census of Agriculture says more than half of today's farmers are over the age of 55. The mentorship program aims to encourage more young people to enter the industry as older farmers retire. The program requires new farmers to complete a certain number of on-the-job training hours while checking off certain lessons in a workbook. The experienced farmers pay their students a salary, and some offer bonus incentives. Joe Tamandel founded the program and says it's based on classic guild apprenticeships. Authorities in northeastern Wisconsin are trying to figure out how human remains ended up in a burned vehicle. WFRV reports that the vehicle was discovered early Saturday morning near railroad tracks running along the Fox River in Kaukauna. Inside the vehicle were human skeletal remains. The incident remains under investigation. This is WPR.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Association, committed to carrying on UW traditions and uniting alumni through the University of Wisconsin's annual campaign. More at supportuw.org.
WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College and is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. To learn more and to take full advantage of our services, visit WGTD.org. To have a program schedule mailed to you, call 262-564-3030.
If you haven't yet been outside, take note, it's cold out there. Today's wind chills could hit between 5 and 10 degrees in the south. 5 and 10 degrees below in the south. Wind chills up north, negative 30. And those brisk air temperatures could last into the evening. Otherwise, cloudy across the state.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 20 years of grant-making to jazz artists and the organizations that support them. Learn more at ddcf.org. From LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform, committed to helping get work done in today's modern workforce. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. And now that a tax overhaul bill has been signed into law, the White House is turning to its next big priority, infrastructure. NPR's David Shaper talked to Rachel Martin.
Anyone who got toy dump trucks, bulldozers, even cranes under their Christmas tree might be delighted to hear that the next priority is infrastructure. NPR's transportation correspondent David Shaper joins us now to talk about this. Hey, David.
Good morning.
All right. So President Trump has talked a lot over the course of the past year, even on the campaign trail, about infrastructure, spending $1 trillion to fix and improve roads, bridges, tunnels, airports. Is that what this finally is?
Not really. It's not $1 trillion anyway, not in direct federal spending. It'll be closer to about $200 billion over 10 years. Some of that will go to rural infrastructure projects. Some will be reserved for what's being called transformational projects. But the bulk of the $200 billion would go toward leveraging state and local money and private investment. Those state and local funds and private financing would, in theory, then make up the rest of that $1 trillion that the president talks about. But it's not exactly what a lot of people were looking for.
When the president's first started talking about a $1 trillion infrastructure package, I think a lot of us were hopeful that it was going to be $1 trillion in cash.
That's Jim Timon with the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. He likes a part of the plan that would give state and local officials more control over construction projects. But using federal funding to leverage state and local funds and private investments worries him.
That is going to be a tougher sell in some parts of the country that aren't used to partnering with the private sector or financing or going into debt to build a project.
One concern is that this almost certainly would lead to more tolls, and people don't like tolls. But it's clear the administration wants to get away from the old way of doing things with big federal spending from Washington and to instead direct funding to projects where cities and states put their own skin in the game, too. Robert Puentes is with the nonpartisan Eno Center for Transportation.
And this actually makes sense because we have seen states and cities and metropolitan areas across the country raising their own taxes, going to the voters, having them approve measures at the ballot box, and these things are generally popular outside of Washington.
At least 30 states have raised their own gas or sales taxes in recent years to fund transportation, and dozens of cities and counties have approved tax hikes to fund transit. But not everyone can do that. And Puente says another problem is even that initial $200 billion in federal funding may be hard to come by.
We've got this huge tax bill. We have an omnibus appropriations package. We have emergency hurricane relief. We've got the children's health insurance, things that are super high priorities that may actually sweep up all of these pay-fors that we have for even that $200 billion.
So, David, we heard there that certain states have been raising their own state gas taxes to try to pay for some of this infrastructure. What about increasing the federal gas tax? I mean, that hasn't been raised in a long time, right?
Yeah, it's been about a quarter of a century, but that's not going to be part of this package, not likely anyway. A White House official told me that the $200 billion would likely be coming from budget cuts from other unspecified federal programs.
Do we know anything more? I mean, if they want budget cuts to pay for this, it'd have to be a big cut.
And that's a real concern. I mean, it's not sitting well with congressional Democrats because we don't know where that money would be coming from. They fear it would be cutting essential programs to a lot of Democrats. And the administration is going to need some Democrats to support this infrastructure bill because it would need 60 votes in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And even some conservative Republicans might push back on this notion that states would have to raise their own taxes. So while infrastructure spending initially has bipartisan appeal, the administration needs to do some of its own political bridge building first in order to get this plan through.
I see what you did there, bridge building.
Yeah.
NPR's transportation correspondent, David Shaper. Thanks so much, David.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Okay, right now we are going to check in on an American Santa Claus in France. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley takes us to a village Christmas pageant with an unlikely Saint Nick.
Aurélie Garat, Christmas pageant organizer for the tiny town of Vimoutiers, still can't get over how she found their Père Noël this year.
I was parking, and I saw a nice young man with a beautiful beard sitting in his car on the phone, and I said to him, "Your beard speaks to me. Would you be our Father Christmas this year?"
That heaven-sent Santa is 66-year-old retired American photographer Tom Haley, who happens to be fixing up a house he recently bought near Vimoutiers. Haley says he wasn't actually so surprised by Garat's request.
For several years now, I'm walking along in Paris or anywhere, and kids all of a sudden stop in their tracks like they see Santa Claus.
Ho, ho, ho!
Dressed in a century-old red felt hood and cape, Haley takes his place in a carriage pulled by a donkey. He's surrounded by children dressed as elves and characters from fairy tales. The joyous party is soon joined by an organ grinder. After a stop at the retirement home, the little pageant arrives in the town square. There's a Christmas market and a big comfy chair awaits Père Noël.
They're going to invite the people to bring their kids to have a photo with Père Noël. This is quite an experience. Bonjour, jeune homme.
Haley takes each enfant upon his knee.
Et les Barbie.
Ah, des Barbie.
Six-year-old Luna wants Barbie dolls. Other less young residents also visit Santa for a talk.
Donc,
travailler une fromagerie.
Ah oui?
88-year-old André Boursier tells Haley how she worked her whole life as a cheesemaker. She refuses to sit in his lap.
Ah oui?
But tells him, yes, she still believes in Père Noël. Haley has a connection to Normandy that goes back to his father, who landed here on D-Day plus two. He says in the 1990s, he and his father returned and were able to find the farm where his company bivouacked.
This older gentleman answered the door, and I explained to him what we were doing there and that my father had landed on Omaha Beach. And the guy just sort of broke down and grabbed my father in his arms and hugged him. I mean, it was incredible.
Oui, on est content et on est d'origine marocaine.
Today, Vimoutier has a Muslim community. Like others, Lubna Setkawi's parents immigrated here from Morocco in the decades after World War II. Setkawi brings her children out to celebrate Christmas because she says it's important to share in each other's holidays and culture. And she says having an American Père Noël this year gives them another culture to celebrate. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Vimoutier, France.
This is NPR News.
And on this Christmas morning, it is 8:41. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Up next, we'll bring you headlines. Those are coming live from NPR and WPR.
Tune into Wisconsin Public Television Thursday nights at 7:30 for Tribal Histories. Join tribal leaders and elders from the Lakotare Ojibwe, Mole Lake Ojibwe, and St. Croix Ojibwe communities to hear the stories of creation, culture, struggle, and rebirth in their own words. Tribal Histories, Thursday nights at 7:30 on Wisconsin Public Television.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Guatemala has announced it will move its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports Guatemala's president made the announcement after a phone call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Guatemala's president announced the decision on Christmas Eve after a conversation with Netanyahu. Guatemala voted against a UN resolution last week that rejected Trump's declaration on Jerusalem. Israel has supported Guatemala with security and arms sales for many years. Palestinians also have claims in Jerusalem, and a Palestinian official says Guatemala's decision is disappointing.
NPR's Daniel Estrin. Hundreds of thousands of people in Vietnam's Mekong Delta have been evacuated as the region braces for the arrival of a tropical storm which left more than 150 people dead in the Philippines. The BBC's Louise Lair reports.
It's just making landfall, the first signs of it, across the southern half of Vietnam towards Ho Chi Minh City. And it has weakened a little. That is good news, but nevertheless, it's still a powerful storm. And the heavy rainfall, the strong winds, the high storm surge could lead to some devastating flooding in those low-lying areas, and hence the reason that hundreds of thousands of people have been evacuated.
The BBC's Louise Lair reporting. I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. A yearly golf tournament in northeastern Wisconsin has raised more than $5.5 million for area social service agencies. The money goes to the Basic Needs Giving Partnership, which is sponsored by area businesses. This year, 163 social service agencies will receive grants to address things like housing, literacy, and sobriety. Matt Valiquette is with the Green Bay Area Workforce Development Board. He says the grants have been a force multiplier.
In addition to that, we've leveraged other resources, primarily through the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, which really we took the total amount we're receiving from this particular grant, $100,000 a year, we leveraged that into more than a $4 million a year project.
Valiquette says the Workforce Board is using the money across 17 counties to connect people with training or jobs. Students at a working farm and hands-on classroom in Wisconsin are learning about the benefits of stopping soil erosion. North Central Technical College is working with the National Corn Growers Association to preserve and improve topsoil. The center is teaching farmers to practice no-till and cover crop agriculture as ways to preserve root structure and stop erosion. Scientists say climate change is threatening strides made in soil conservation since the Dust Bowl years of the 1930s. A report from the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts says the warming trend in Wisconsin is producing more frequent heavy rain that's washing away the soil. You're listening to WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from CDW, committed to helping companies identify hidden malware and other risks, and offering a CDW threat check. CDW, people who get it. From Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure wildlife and wild lands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org. And from listeners like you who donate to your NPR station at the end of the year.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. And these days, everyone has the internet on their phone, and so it's easier than ever to look up words that confuse us. But that also means it's easier than ever for the dictionary to know what we're looking up. So when Merriam-Webster put out its annual list of top 10 words of the year, we decided to call them and see if we could learn something from what people are searching. Our co-host Rachel Martin talked about some of the top words of 2017 with Merriam-Webster's editor-at-large, Peter Sokolowski.
I want to get right to this. None of this countdown from number 10. Let's start with what everybody wants to know, which is, what is the number one word of 2017?
The Merriam-Webster word of the year is feminism.
Feminism, the number one word of the year. I mean, can you measure when this happened? Because clearly the second half of the year is when we saw the Me Too movement explode and allegations of sexual harassment and sexual assault, which provoked a bigger conversation about women and their role in society. And I imagine that then triggered a lot of online searches for the word feminism.
It absolutely did, and you're completely correct. But, you know, there are three other occasions, and two in particular, that had very specific spikes. The first was the Women's March in January that had an enormous spike. And there were lots of conversations, as you know, lots of discussions whether this march was feminist, what kind of feminism was represented in the march. And the word was sort of in the air. The next big spike we saw was in February when Kellyanne Conway said in an interview that she didn't consider herself a feminist. And that's the kind of thing that triggers dictionary curiosity, because the word itself was the story. There was the Hulu series of The Handmaid's Tale, which not only got great reviews, but got, again, a huge amount of interest in terms of what it says about the culture today. And, of course, the solo film of Wonder Woman.
What about some of your other favorites?
Our runners-up tend to be sort of one-hit wonders. In other words, words that are associated with an individual story. So what we have is, for example, complicit, the word that was used in a skit on Saturday Night Live about Ivanka Trump. And then the word was used in an interview with Ivanka Trump. And there in the interview, she said, "I don't know what complicit means." And you better believe that sends people to the dictionary.
How long has Merriam-Webster been doing this?
The word of the year?
Yeah.
Since 2003. The real interesting story here is that we never had a measure of the public's curiosity until we put the dictionary online. And suddenly we could see what words people were looking up and when. The first time this happened was just 20 years ago when Princess Diana died. And the word that was most looked up was paparazzi.
Huh.
You know, 9/11, the most looked up word was the word surreal. And so we were able to see what the public was really thinking about according to what they were looking up in the dictionary.
Oh, so interesting. You presumably have been doing this for a while. Have you learned anything about how we are evolving as English speakers based on the words that make up the top 10 lists over time?
The first thing I've learned is that words matter, that people do pay attention, and that in an age of alternative facts and fake news, having a neutral arbiter of meaning ends up being pretty important to a lot of people. And turning to the dictionary in these moments is not just for spelling or pronunciation, but also maybe the beginning of reflection and philosophy. I mean, the word love is one of the most looked up words in the dictionary, and it's probably not for spelling.
Peter Sokolowski is the editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster. Thank you so much, Peter. And I guess we'll just see what new words come to the fore in 2018.
Exactly. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
This is NPR News.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Thank you so much for tuning in on this Christmas morning here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll actually have holiday music coming up in about 15 minutes. It's Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins and a very holiday version. Coming up next on Morning Edition, in 1945, singer Mel Torme famously wrote one of the most well-known holiday songs of all time, the Christmas song. Learn its history next.
WPR's Musical Heritage Tour through Burkhalter Travel moves from Nashville to New Orleans over a 10-day stretch in late April. On day 5, travelers will follow the path of the Mississippi River deep into the Mississippi Delta to experience the Delta Blues Museum and the Ground Zero Blues Club in Clarksdale before a trek to Greenwood to tour a number of national historical sites seen in the movie The Help. More information is available at wpr.org/travel.
A good brisk morning to you. It's cold across Wisconsin today, and it will be for the rest of the week. Wind chills could hit 5 to negative 10 degrees in the south, all the way to negative 30 up in the northern parts of Wisconsin, and those brisk winds will last into the evening. Some parts of the state may see flurries through the afternoon, otherwise cloudy day for us.
Support for WPR comes from the Milwaukee Symphony, screening E.T. the Extraterrestrial while the symphony performs the soundtrack live at the Marcus Center this Saturday, plus a matinee on New Year's Eve. Tickets are at mso.org.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. Allow the compassionate, caring staff at Piasecki Althaus to take care of your funeral needs, serving the community since 1931.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And on this Christmas morning, I'm Noelle King.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
In 1946, Nat King Cole was the first recording artist to wrap his luscious voice around what would become a standard of the season, the Christmas song. But that song was written by a different crooner, Mel Torme.
Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright.
There is a terrific story behind the writing of this song, and we thought the best person to tell it would be Mel Torme's youngest son, James. He himself is a jazz singer. James Torme, welcome to the show.
Noelle, thanks for having me.
So this song is a Christmas classic. It evokes a frigid winter day, you know, folks dressed up like Eskimos, but there is a twist.
Oh, yeah. In the summer of 1945, the year before the song's release, it was a very hot, sort of an oppressive summer that summer. And my father went to the house of his then writing partner, a guy called Bob Wells. And Wells was nowhere to be seen. But there was a spiral pad at the piano. There were four lines sort of scribbled down on it in pencil. Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. And when Bob Wells eventually appeared, he said, you know, Mel, I have tried everything to cool down. I've been in my pool. I had a cold drink. I've taken a cold shower. I'm nothing but hot. And I thought that maybe, you know, if I could just write down a few lines of wintry verse, I could psychologically get an edge over this heat.
Wishful thinking.
So my dad sort of looked at Bob, looked back down at the spiral pad, and then looked back at Wells and said, I think there's something here. And about 45 minutes later, no more than that, the song was born.
They know that Santa's on his way.
The two of them, you know, they got kind of excited about it and drove it over to Van Heusen Publishing, where those guys said to them, no, nobody would ever want a song like this that's only really going to be popular one day of the year.
Huh.
So they a little bit dejected, took the song the same afternoon to the house of a guy called Nat Cole.
And so I
played the song once for Nat, and he said, play that again.
Wow.
And they played it one more time, and before they could get done, he said, stop everything. That's my song.
Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
I love that story, but I do wonder, your dad himself had such a beautiful voice. Did he ever think about keeping that song for himself?
You're right. But the simple truth is, Nat Cole was simply exploding at that particular moment in time. And so my dad and Bob Wells sort of, you know, they just put it in his hands and said, you know what, you take this. We want you to have this.
I'm talking to James Torme, the son of legendary singer Mel Torme. And James, the Christmas song is not the only Christmas song your dad wrote. In fact, you're reviving one of his songs called The Christmas Feeling. Tell me about that song.
It's a song that I discovered through doing my father's symphony arrangements that I do all over the world with celebrated orchestras. And
so you didn't know anything about this other Christmas song, The Christmas Feeling, when you were a kid growing up?
I didn't. That was a little bit of an epiphany for me. And just the fact that it seemed like it was so contemporary, the melody of the song, and yet these beautiful, timeless lyrics, a lot like, in fact, chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
The Christmas feeling, that time when we will once again sing all the carols while we trim the tree. We'll open presents and we'll watch the children play. And then we'll gather round the table Christmas Day.
All right, and now I want to hear your interpretation of the Christmas feeling. Let's take a listen to that.
The Christmas feeling, the time when we will once again sing all the carols while we trim the tree.
We'll James, your dad, Mel Torme, passed away when you were in your mid-20s, almost 20 years ago. And I wonder, when you hear his songs, when you hear his voice, and when you sing his songs, what kind of memories does that evoke?
Well, the whole thing is sort of a double-edged sword from an emotional point of view. During the Christmas holidays, I'm hearing my father. You know, you go into a mall, be in a mall in London or something, and there he'll come on. I sometimes get very emotional about it, but overall, I just look at it as, hey, my dad's saying hi. You know, that's the way I choose to look at it. You asked me the type of memories that I have. We had magical Christmases as kids. My sister Daisy and I, Mr. Christmas, we used to call Dad. An accomplishment for a Jew.
Yeah.
It was the fake sleigh marks in the front yard and the singing music together in four-part harmonies. Dad made our Christmases very, very special. So it just, you know, it brings a smile to my face and a sort of a glow to my heart when I'm walking around somewhere and suddenly I hear Dad.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
That is James Torme, the son of Mel Torme. James, thank you so much and Merry Christmas.
Hey, you too. Thanks for having me.
Where the treetops glisten.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Merry Christmas from all of us. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green.
Sleigh bells in the snow.
And Merry Christmas. It is just about 9 o'clock. Remember that you can hear Morning Edition from 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Don't go anywhere. We have a very special holiday version of Morning Classics coming up next. Stephanie Elkins brings you all the hits. next year on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Neff's Piano, The Bolt Company, and El Morro Vineyards. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha Public Museum announces the opening of the Richard Harris Collection, Memento Mori, The Art of Death, on display from December 16th through February 25th. For more, call 653-4140.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.